The money print is corrosive. It destroys everything. If the government can increase the number of dollars in existence with the click of a button, they've devalued that dollar you just worked for. And the natural consequence of all of these things is the money goes down in purchasing power forever. Bitcoin is the perfection of money. It is, you know, gold was inefficient energy money. Bitcoin is perfect energy money. It's the apex evolution of money. And you can do it at almost zero cost. Bitcoin is the way we separate money and state. It's the way we reinstate human rights for everyone around the world. You know, it's about the individual.
So, yeah, I met Joe just like a few minutes ago, but where I really met Joe is on his video called What's the Problem? And it was sent to me by one of my really good friends, Constantine, who's, I was telling Joe, one of the most diehard Bitcoiners I've ever met in my life, probably the most hardcore Bitcoiner I've ever met. And he sent it to me because I've had guests on the channel that have communicated Bitcoin's potential. We had a CERN basher who sort of walked me through the like a very meticulous financial reason why Bitcoin makes a lot of sense. I brought on Constantine and Topher, who are sort of local Bitcoiners here in the Austin community, to walk me through more through the technical aspect of it. Because I had some questions around, you know, like the how safe is it against hacks? How safe is it against quantum, you know, computing? And, you know, all that, the common technical stuff that comes through. But I really wanted to deep down and drill down on very specific points, which they really helped me get my head wrapped around. And then Joe Bryan, for those that are not familiar, has a video on YouTube called What's the Problem, which is a very, very fascinating way of viewing this whole Bitcoin thing. Number one, because the title and the thumbnail of the video is like completely inconspicuous. I mean, you could, you're like, you're looking at the title and thumbnail and it's like, what's the problem? It's like, huh? And it's just like this cartoonish old guy or whatever on the thumbnail, if I remember correctly. Yeah. And I'm like, wow, that is so simple and like basic, but it has like 250 or 300,000 views. I can't remember how many views it had when I watched it. And I'm like, okay, there's something going on here. So I watched it and it's the way you laid out the way you sort of started from the reality of the situation and then tied everything back to the reason why we have, you know, the wealth gap and political instability and so many different other reasons why societies tend to sort of go through the cycle of boom and bust, boom and bust, boom and bust is from your thesis perspective, it's because of the quality of the money and yeah. the sort of the guardrails that are put around that money or the lack of guardrails that are put around that money and who has the ability or what has the ability to change the rules around that money. And so and then correct me at any point if I'm missing any of this sort of Bitcoin is this, this, I don't want to call anything perfect, but it's by far the best solution from my perspective to shore up a lot of the weaknesses around money. And if that thesis is correct, then the downstream effects is that you have vastly less political violence, vastly less instability, vastly less of a huge issue between the wealth gap. You know, you're not inflating away people's hard-earned money and value they've created that just basically disappears over time. You know, all that effort they put in, all that work just is gone instead of, you know, being brought along with a growing pie and a growing economy. So I'm going to shut up and I'm just going to let you sort of walk through, you know, did I get that idea correct? And if I did, how did you land on this concept? Because that's where I'm very fascinated. You just tied in so many loose ends on this thing for me. And so, yeah, go ahead. Go for it, Joe.
Well, this is probably the culmination of close to 5 years of thinking, learning, consuming the output and the hard work of other insightful people. Because, you know, as you've said, Bitcoin is pretty inaccessible for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And it was very inaccessible to start with. It was just a PDF on an email to 200 people. And so you had to be a cryptographer to even get access to it and then start to assess it and think about the implications and the consequences and all of these things. And over time, over 16 years, we're still very, very early, but more and more layers of accessibility have been wrapped around the core of what Bitcoin is. And that, you know, from the engineering perspective, from the financial perspective, et cetera, it makes it more digestible for the next person who arrives.
Yeah.
Now, I think what I've managed to do with What's the Problem is make it accessible to anybody. The rationale as to why we need Bitcoin.
Yeah. And if you don't mind, Joe, can you maybe give a synopsis of like what that rationale is in your own words? Because you just communicated it so beautifully in the video and I fucking botched it. So go for it.
Oh, no, you did a great job. I thought I'm not going to need to talk at all on this interview. I mean, it really comes down to someone's got a big red button that they can press and change any of the characteristics of the money. And that is unfair on every single possible level. And the world that we see around us today has, you know, dozens, hundreds of issues that you could write down. And if you were looking at all of the issues that we face, whether it's things you've already mentioned or obesity or homelessness or, you know, the breakdown of the nuclear family or the pension crisis, any of these things, they've all got the same root cause. But if you looked at the issues, it would take a lot of inference to figure out where they all came from, because they're one, two, three, four steps removed from the thing that precipitated them. And it's like it's a bit like Bitcoin, and we can come back to why it's a bit like Bitcoin and sort of mining Bitcoin. But when you run the explanation one way, it's very, very hard. But if you run the explanation the other way, it's very, very easy. So trying to go from the issues and tie them all back to where they came from, doing that independently is almost impossible.
Right.
But over 16 years, as people think about it and they connect the dots and these sorts of things, you can then, when What's the Problem, create a story where you start from the very beginning and you just run it forward. And you run it forward with a set of circumstances that just reflect the quality of the money. And when you set the ball rolling with certain characteristics of the money, either they're fixed or they're variable, because someone has a big red button. The big red button gets pressed, the characteristics of the money change, and we end up in today's world.
Yeah.
And you can see from first principles thinking, very small steps all along the way, with no giant leaps, it's all human logic, how we end up with all the issues that we have today. And it's all because of the money. The money is broken. The money is broken. And it's deliberately broken. And so, you know, I've effectively abstracted the entire financial system into just a big red button.
Yeah.
Right? Which I realize is a gross, you know, simplification. But it does the job, because really all the button is the flexibility we have in the money that allows the people in charge to change what it means and how it works.
Yeah.
Rather than it being locked in and a set of rules that everybody plays by and no one can change the rules. And, you know, if you are forced to live your life and make decisions in your life based on a variable rule set that you cannot predict, you have no control over, you're not going to win. It's like playing a board game, Farzad. Like if you and I played a board game and I was allowed to change the rules whenever I wanted, you're not going to win the board game.
Right.
Right. And at some point while you're playing the board game, you're probably going to lose motivation about playing the game.
Yeah.
Because you realize you're never going to win. You're only going to lose. So you start to become disengaged and, you know, lose interest and, you know, a lot of other consequences. That's sort of really in an abstract sense, but in a more specific sense, there's two core things. One is that the person who the owner of the big red button is the government. And I use the government, but brackets central bank. They are one and the same. They're nominally independent, but they're appointed by the government, can be changed by the government, have their mandate changed by the government. So they're not really independent.
Yep.
But the central bank is able to bring money into existence, or print money for free. You and I have to work for it.
Yeah.
That's the first one. And the second one is that the money is not censorship resistant. So the money itself can change meaning, and we don't own the money we think we own. And so maybe if we talk about both of those separately,
yeah,
because they are the two major shortcomings in the money we use.
Yeah.
So if you'd like me just to dig into
please do.
Into the yeah, yeah. first one.
Please do.
Yeah. And so if someone can print money for free, but you have to work for it, that is theft of your life. Because you go into a day's work today and you get paid X amount of dollars. You've expended your time, energy, economic ingenuity in whatever it is, right? You've added value to somebody else and they have rewarded you with dollars. Now those dollars have a certain purchasing power today. And that purchasing power is a function of the total number of dollars that exist against the backdrop of the goods and services that exist today.
Yep. Yep.
If the government can increase the number of dollars in existence with the click of a button, they've devalued that dollar you just worked for. They've stolen the purchasing power without having to do the work. You had to do the work to own it. They didn't have to do the work to create it. And so inflation is theft of your life.
Yep.
In the very simplest terms, you have to work longer because somebody's printing it for free.
Can we put that in? So I'm going to go ahead and, if you don't mind, Joe, I'm going to put that in layman's terms so that the audience can follow along with that specific point, because we just had a huge thing that happened not even 5 years ago, the whole COVID thing, right? And we'll use that as an example in the U.S. So you saw, if you're a common person, if you're just a regular person, anybody really, you're going to the grocery store, you're going to buy something. It used to be a dollar. Then COVID happened, and a couple of years later, that same exact thing was like $1.30, $1.40, whatever it was. Why did that happen? Because the Fed, which claims to be independent, but we see how, you know, the politics behind the Fed, we see how these things work together. They are mandated by the government to create certain actions, right? The Fed went, oh, crisis, red button, right? Boom. And then a bunch of new dollars flew right into the economy. And then what did that do? It devalued everyone's purchasing power by introducing new money into the system. But by default, what that does, it doesn't just give everybody the ability to buy more stuff. Everyone's dollar becomes less because the total money supply grew, but the total value of the economy is the same. I guess that's like a maybe incorrect way of thinking about it, but I'm just trying to communicate like very plainly that action forced people to have to work harder for the same grocery thing they were buying. Not even 2 years before. Now they have to go and put in more work to buy the same thing, right? Because those wages didn't keep up with the inflation. Inflation vastly outstripped the wages during that period, right? I want to make sure I crystallize that. Let me know if that was, yeah.
That's entirely correct. And before, because I think we should try and pick that apart, Fazad, because there's several different aspects of inflation that don't get talked about.
Yeah.
And I think it would be helpful for your audience to be able to tie back the fact that they all come from the money printer in their various forms. But before we do that, it's probably worth just zooming out and saying, like, why is it even like this?
Right.
Like, why do we even have inflation? You know, we hear about it on the TV every single day. It's like surprise, you know, inflation's gone up more or less than expected, and the Fed has a target for inflation. It's all just theft. Is it the Fed saying we have a target of 2% or now it's 3% perhaps? Is like, we're going to steal 3% off you forever, every single year, because it's needed for the economy.
Right.
But then they'll blame inflation on some mysterious background force. So we all live with inflation, and we all assume these days, because we've had it for so long, that it's natural. It's a natural function of a healthy economy.
Yeah. It's like air or water. Thank you to the sponsor of this podcast, Rebellion Air. Now, we know a lot of you are Tesla fans, and especially Tesla investors. And if you have more than $1 million of Tesla stock, Rebellion Air could be the perfect fit for you. Rebellion Air is an investment firm that helps Tesla investors reach their financial goals. They do this by helping you plan for your future, and they also institute strategies like trimming and adding, covered calls, etc. So if you're somebody who believes that Tesla has long-term potential, these kinds of strategies could maximize the number of shares you have by the time Tesla reaches those goals. And the guys at Rebellion Air do this by doing so much research on the Tesla story, and they do a lot of novel research as well. Things like doing cross-country full self-driving trips to really gauge and truly understand the capability of that specific software. They've done really novel research around the energy side of the business and other parts of the business as well. And so instead of dealing with a typical investment firm that may give you the cold shoulder by viewing your investment as too risky, the guys at Rebellion Air will help you reach your goals while fully understanding the Tesla story. And so if you're a Tesla investor and you have more than $1 million of shares, and you're interested in finding out more about Rebellion Air, I have a link for you in the description in the comment section below. You can go to rebellionair.com/Farzad, and that's how they'll know that we sent you. And now back to the podcast.
Yeah. But it's entirely wrong. It's entirely wrong. And you can show this in 60 seconds that inflation shouldn't exist. Right. And I'll go back to the video and encourage people to watch the video after this. But if you imagine you have a money that nobody can create for free, nobody can create extra, and you have a free market where people can compete with one another. And on the island, there's a bunch of survivors of a shipwreck get washed up on an island. When they first land there, they don't have anything, so they're trying to survive. Right, so you're doing some fishing for some food, you're cutting down some trees for some firewood and building materials, and you're building your own shelter. You don't really have any excess. Despite you've got this perfect money, you're just about surviving. Whereas, you know, you're probably better at fishing and I'm better at cutting down the trees. So you spend all your time fishing, I'll cut down the trees, we can produce twice the amount in half the time, and now we have excess.
And I'm pretty bad at fishing, so I hope you must be terrible. Well,
yeah, I'm absolutely awesome. Okay. We'll be starving.
Yeah.
But you can see by specializing, you can increase the quantity you can produce, reduce the amount of time you're spending, and the net impact of that is to reduce prices.
Yep.
Because just the natural law of demand and supply. You've reduced prices and you're better at it. So the output quality goes up, right? And we're not the only people doing it. There's lots of people fishing, lots of people cutting down trees, lots of people building shelters, and everyone's competing.
Yeah.
And everybody else, you can't build a house out of fish. You can't start a fire out of fish. You've got to trade with me. And so when you buy firewood or you buy building materials, you're making that decision based on a combination of price and quality. I want the best quality at the lowest price.
Yeah.
So what does it do? It drives competition. People invest more of their free time in trying to improve their processes, drive higher quality outcomes, drive prices lower. So when you have a free market, the natural human action when you have sound money, perfect money, is that prices go down and quality goes up. And that happens forever because there's no point at which you become free of competition. Become free of innovation because we're human beings. We're constantly striving, creating more specialization systems. So the natural state of the world when you have good money and free markets is that prices go down every year and the quality goes up. Now that within 60 seconds.
It's a mind-blowing statement, right? Right? Yeah. I just want to hone in on that, right? Because if you look at it from a first principles perspective and you walk through that example, right? So like, can we try and play devil's advocate here? So for me to play a devil's advocate on this is to say that what we assume of human nature is not actually human nature, right? That would be one of my pushbacks. It's like, okay, so humans don't always want to innovate. Humans don't always want to work harder. Humans don't always want to make things better. Humans, you know, at some point, you know, maybe they don't want to be competitive. They reach a certain level of happiness and like, okay, we're all good, right? And so at some point, we're going to reach an equilibrium of the human desire, and then the concept about things will always get cheaper and better sort of crumbles. So what's your response to that?
Well, I think that's fanciful. That's fanciful. I mean, human nature is to want to drive a better life for yourself, to have purpose in life and motivation and to compete. But this is innate. It may not be innate in every single human being. You know, and I think there's probably there'll be people you'll know who are, you would consider to be relentlessly productive people.
Yeah.
And for them, working is not working. Working is their passion. It's their hobby. It's their drive. It's where they get the motivation from. And there'll be people you know who are happy to let everyone else do it and get stuff for free. You have a spectrum of the human condition. But the reality is, you drive improvements of your life through your actions and competition. And so everything is a competition, especially when, and you feel that, you know, and there'll be men and women listening, but men and women are very different. You know, as a father, you feel responsibility to provide for your family and to make their lives better, better than you had. And that's a innate biological thing, I would guess. And so if the argument that we have inflation now is that everybody's given up, everyone's happy with their lot, I don't really buy it. And maybe we reach some sort of utopia where that is the case, but I just don't see it, because it's biological. It's the biological evolution playing out in our human action. And you know, if you as an individual chose to stop being competitive, to raise your prices or deliver a lower quality product, that may work for a short period of time. But in a free market, you're going to lose.
Yep.
Your customers will churn. Someone will recognize that you're making too much profit and they'll come and compete with you. And this is why capitalism is the greatest force for good in the world. This is like the most moral system. The most moral system is you driving a competitive outcome for the benefit of everybody else. Everyone works in their own self-interest and it benefits everybody because it raises the standard of living for everyone. And so, you know, when you've got sound money and prices—
As long as we have deflation. As long as we have deflation from the higher quality
which goods. Is what happens naturally. Yeah. Naturally, as you can see, sometimes prices go up if something becomes in demand or there's a shortage of something. But free markets resolve this. If prices go up and the profit margin grows, it attracts. It's a price signal to all the entrepreneurs, the active capital, to come and compete for it and compete it away. And this just happens forever. And so, capitalism drives an increase in the quality of life for everybody, even if they're unproductive.
Right.
Because if you think about the unproductive person who has some savings, even if they're a meager amount of savings, in a free market with perfect money and prices are falling, that buys more next year than it does this year. You're not forced to spend it before it melts. You're not seeing prices go up every 2 weeks when you go to the supermarket and having to make compromises on your decision making, right? So, before we delve into the inflation, the various types of inflation, how that manifests itself in destroying society, it's good to have that initial anchor of what the world should be like, because then you've got this massive contrast. It's like, well, obviously the world should be like that. So why on earth is it not? What's wrong with it that it's not that way?
Yeah, and this is the crystallization around, you know, the subject around the quality of money. The downstream effects from not having that are so far reaching. and the second, third, fourth order effects of having a red button, sort of like the ability, fiat, it's just fiat money, by default, sludges up innovation and deflation and an individual's ability to put in work in at any time, get the value from that work back in the form of money, and then being able to utilize that money at a later time and benefit from the improvements in society, from the innovation that's driven by the human condition. But we have the opposite. We have the literal opposite. Is when somebody puts in work, unless they are, you know, and the education around money and our financial system is a whole separate discussion, because we have to, like, from my perspective, we have two poor things. We have shitty money, and then we have really shitty education about the shitty money. Right. So people don't even know how to use the shitty money properly. Right. Because, it, you know, once you become an investor, you realize, holy shit, if I don't take my dollars and I put it into something that's going to outpace the inflation that we're going to get from the devaluation of money, I'm really going to get fucked. Right. And so that's why one becomes an investor. That's why things like Robinhood are so popular. That's why the younger generations are like, what the fuck's going on? I'm going to start trading and try to, you know, buy Bitcoin and stuff. Right. Because now there's an awakening to this, like, to this force of sludging up the human condition, and people are trying to guard themselves from it. But the default should be that people, by default, should just benefit from the actions of humanity, making humanity better, right? Absolutely. Why isn't that the default system?
That is the default. It's just been corrupted. And
fair.
And the shitty education, as you refer to it, is a function of the shitty money. Because if you have access to a big red button and you get to control education, you absolutely don't educate anybody to the level that they understand there's dangers about having a big red button. It's just, I mean, show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. This is where we are. But, you know, almost everything you see in your life that is a problem is made more of a problem because the money is corrupt. Now, humans will always create problems because we're humans. Yes. Right? They just won't be on steroids everywhere. And some of them just won't exist. And so, you know, if we think about what happens when you go from having perfect money in a free market and then someone's allowed to start printing the money. When government starts printing the money, and you can abstract away how that works because it's via the banking system, via QE, lots of different ways to try and abstract from the core principle, they're just diluting the money supply. Then that money ultimately finds its way into the economy from the government through government spending, okay, or bank lending. That money comes into existence that did not exist before. But when it comes into the economy, somebody's getting paid that money. So to them, it just looks like demand, right? But it's not demand, it's just extra money. It's not new demand, it's just extra money, right? But when you've got demand and supply and then the demand goes up, what happens? The prices go up.
Yeah. Right?
When measured in the money, right? And so the government starts spending with people connected to the government. And just like we said before, when you have a shortage of something, the price goes up, the profitability goes up, and it attracts entrepreneurs and capital to it. The same thing happens. The government spends money in certain areas of the economy. It's a price signal to everyone else that there's something to play for and compete for closer to the government. And so now you get productive people that get attracted away from what they're currently competing for and closer to the government.
Crazy. Right?
And so they make the rest of the economy less competitive, less productive. So you stop seeing the prices decline in those areas. And you start to see them pull closer to the government, competing for something which is not real. It's just extra money. It's never real demand. Right. So the efficiency of the economy starts to get shaken as the price signals are compromised. And then as these companies start to spend money on other things, because every company needs energy, needs raw materials, needs human beings, right? that starts to wash into all the inputs. And then suddenly every business in the economy, even if you're a restaurant down the road, you start seeing your costs go up, your input costs go up. You are a million miles from the government, right? But people now cost more, energy costs more, the inputs, the materials all cost more, right? Because of this extra money. It's not extra demand. And so you've got a menu where you've got all your prices and you know what your profit margins are. And as an entrepreneur, you're taking risk to run the business, right? It's not risk-free. I'm competing for a certain level of profitability here. And if that falls too low, it's not worth the risk reward for me. So I'll close the business. I'll go and work for someone else. They can take the risk, right?
And they'll go work for the government.
We'll go work for the government. Half the country now works for the government, probably, which sort of gives you an indication as the scale.
Can I give you a crazy stat? Actually, in the United States that I just came across to sort of drive home this point beautifully. So if somebody looks at the United States budget, right, and how much we spent last year, we're predicted to spend this year, it's going to be around $6 to $7 trillion. About $2 trillion of that's going to have to be printed. On top of that, right, in some way, because we're going to have a shortfall when it comes to the revenue coming into the government through taxes. So that number is roughly 20 to 25% of the U.S. GDP. About 20% call it of U.S. GDP. And then I went through a bunch of different LLMs and I'm like, okay, what percentage of the U.S. economy is directly or indirectly tied to the government to some form, state, local, federal? It's like 40%. 40% of U.S. GDP, as an example, is directly or indirectly tied to government. And that number absolutely blew my mind. I could not believe that was the number, but it drives home that point. Is that, okay, so if you create an incentive where working for the body that makes the money, if that incentive exists, then of course people are going to go to it, obviously.
Yeah,
and we see it in the numbers.
It's a natural reaction. And it's people reacting to price signals, and the price signals have been compromised by the printing of the money. Unfortunately, this is, you just see that percentage go up and up and up because it becomes like a black hole, like just from gravity.
Yeah.
The more money, the more centralized control, and we can talk about how that all flows downstream from the money printer, but it becomes
it's a flywheel,
a rolling stone that just picks up more and more momentum because there's no way to stop it. Because the only way to solve anything is just to print more money, which causes more problems. The government gets bigger, the more problems it causes, the more money it needs to print to try and solve them, it becomes bigger again. So this is
more money, more problems. All the rappers have said it forever. More problems.
I'm not sure it was quite written about that, but it's very apt, isn't it?
No, I know.
It is shocking. But we can get into how that ends as well, perhaps.
Please.
in a little while.
Yeah.
But if you go back to those entrepreneurs, and it's that every business is now struggling to defend its profit margin. It hasn't changed its prices. It hasn't changed anything about its product. It's just been squeezed by the fact that the government is printing money, bringing money into existence. And so now every entrepreneur has to make a decision. It's like, how do I justify this risk reward? I've got to reinstate the profit margin I had before the government printed the money. Right? It's not entrepreneurs being greedy. It's entrepreneurs just trying to get back to where they were.
Yep.
Right. And so they have to make some changes to their product or service to reinstate it. So the easiest thing is just pass the price increase on. So if you think about a manufactured product, for example, be like, I'll keep it the same quality, same size. I'll just pass on the price increase straight to the customer. So now it's 10% more expensive than it was. Product's exactly the same. 10% inflation. Okay. That's what people think about when they talk about inflation. Price has gone up. That's one aspect. The second one is to say, well, you take the restaurant. Oh, no, let's keep with the productionized goods. I'll keep the price the same because I don't want the customer thinking I put the price up. I'll just make it 10% smaller. The quality is still the same. It's now 10% smaller. That's shrinkflation. which we sometimes see, sometimes we don't see, because sometimes they might do it at the same time as redesigning the packaging or the shape or something like that. And so you're like, I'm sure this used to be a little bit bigger, but because so much has changed, you're not really sure. And I'd say that's semi-visible inflation. It's still inflation, because you just have to buy more of it to get what you originally had. But then there's the third one, which is to say, well, I'll keep the price the same. I'll keep the size the same. But I'll find some way to reduce the cost of producing it.
Right.
So I'm going to have to compromise on the quality of it to some degree versus how it was yesterday.
And the justification from the companies are, well, you know, customers are not really looking for this anyway. Like, we over-engineered, we overproduced it, we over-materialized it. Oh, maybe like the quality, like we shouldn't be using like, you know, titanium. Let's use, I don't know, copper, whatever. Just come up with an example, right? So, and these are the steps they take to make it better. They'll justify it to themselves saying like, it's the same exact quality. We're just getting really efficient with the cost structure of the product. But then you start getting these unforeseen or perhaps expected results, but they're not going to tell you that, right? They're not going to be like, well, this used to last 20 years, but now it lasts five or whatever.
Exactly. Right? Because it's, and quite often it's framed of, we're protecting the consumer from the price increase.
Right.
It's framed in a positive way, but it's because.
And they'll tell the investors, we're returning better returns to you. That's the other way they'll do it.
Yeah. We can be more competitive because our competitor put their price up or they shrunk the product. We can keep it the same. We can just be more efficient. But it's not more efficient. It's compromising on something. And, everyone's making that purchase decision on a combination of price and quality. And if you reduce the quality of something, quite often it's getting rid of people involved in the process, right? Which leads to unemployment. So now the government's got more people who are unemployed. But quite often it's inflation via the back door. It's hidden inflation. So, if you're going to buy something that used to be, used to last a year, and now it only lasts 3 months because they use crappier components, that's on day one, zero inflation.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Over the course of a year, a lot of inflation because now you have to buy it four times.
Yeah.
Right. It's still inflation. It's just spread through time. Right. And that's from a, that's from like a multi-use perspective. But if you think about things that only get used once, like food, if I'm consuming something now, which is of lower quality than it was yesterday, then inflation is zero, but I'm paying the price.
Oh, yeah.
Right. It's inflation manifested in negative human outcomes. It's inflation manifested in health. Yeah. This is where the obesity crisis comes from. Like, we're consuming stuff we should not be consuming. We were never designed to consume the level of industrialized sludge that we consume now. And this is driven from the money printer. It's like the deterioration of quality across everything, goods, services, food. We see it around ourselves everywhere, everywhere. It's a race to the bottom, but it manifests itself in as hidden inflation through negative outcomes for human beings. And this is why, when the Fed talks about inflation, they talk about the price increase, the very visible inflation. They don't talk about the shrinkflation. They absolutely don't talk about the hidden inflation.
Yeah.
So when you sum up those three combinations, it's the consumer. It's the individual who's paying the price for all three of those. One is visible, one's semi-visible, and the other one's completely hidden, but you pay for it forever. And this is what I want people to sort of take away, is that inflation is just corrosive. The money print is corrosive. It destroys everything. Because you think then about the things that fall out of that. If people become unhealthy, they become less productive. Because of it, this is why we have a health crisis, more obesity, more this, more that.
Disenfranchisement. I mean, you become disenfranchised because you're like living in the system, and then the system is just creating poorer and poorer outcomes for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, so think about the average working person who is seeing their cost of living, even just the explicit visible cost of living, going up faster than their paycheck is going up. Every time they go, it's costing them more and more. So they're having to make compromises because they don't have unlimited amounts of money. So they are being forced to make lower quality purchases. They're being forced down this quality spectrum.
Yeah.
Which, you know, so they get less for their money and they get to pay the price forever when they go home and consume it as well. And at the same time, so the third aspect of the money printing, we've talked about the price signals getting distorted. We have consumer inflation, and this is the only source of consumer inflation is printing money because we know prices should be going down.
Yeah. Right?
But the third is that asset prices go up. So if you own a house, you own the stock market, that just goes up. It just goes up over a long period of time. It might have some volatility. It just goes up. But it goes up not because it's become more productive. It's gone up because you've printed more money.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like if you play Monopoly, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So imagine you've got a game of Monopoly and all the houses are sold on the board, right? And there's a certain amount of money in the game. One of the players is the banker, right? And the banker can take money out of the box.
Yeah.
He counts the amount of money on the table and he takes exactly the same amount of money out of the box and puts it next to his pile on the edge of the table. What price do the houses now change hands at if someone wants to buy it?
Right.
Well, at least twice the price before he took the money out of the box.
Right.
So the house prices go up, the stock market goes up just because there's more money in the system. Right. They're not become more valuable. And so if you own the assets, you are probably, for the most part, still losing because the rate at which the money is being printed outstrips the rate at which the assets are going up when you take into account maintenance cost and then the taxes, because whenever you sell it, you've made a gain and you get taxed on the gain. You haven't gained anything. You've gained extra dollars, but the value of that hasn't changed, right? So you give more back to the government. So you're losing, but just not losing to the same degree that somebody who doesn't own the assets is losing. So they're getting squeezed from a cost of living perspective, having to compromise personally on lots of things. And they see their ability to ever own assets get further and further out of view because they become more and more expensive at the same time they're becoming poorer and poorer. Right. And so the only way you can then buy assets or buy a house if you're a young family is to take on a load of debt. You have to get super leveraged just to have somewhere to live.
Yeah.
And then you have this second effect is that when people realize asset prices only go up in the long run, whether they realize it's because of the money printer or not, and they realize that the money goes less far each day, each year, each month, because it's decaying, what do? You realize you can't keep money in the bank because it's melting.
Yeah.
So you go, if I can't keep money in the bank and assets only go up, what do? I buy assets.
Exactly.
Right. So you make the assets go up even faster.
Yeah.
This is why I said they go up at least twice the amount. Twice the amount is the right price for the extra money, but then you've got to think about the change on people's behavior.
Right.
So you start to see speculative assets go up, more and more leverage into the banking system because the banks are like, great, we can just print more and more loans here. We can make origination fees. We can charge interest. And then suddenly everyone's stuffed full of debt. Right. And if you're a family, you now can't buy a house. You can't buy a house on one salary. You can't have Homer Simpson's life. Yeah. But 30 years ago, when they made The Simpsons, right? Yeah, I love this. Yeah. I love this example. I've used it before. When they made The Simpsons, Homer was like the most average guy in America, probably sub-average. Right. On a lot of ways. Sure. Like no one was aspiring to be Homer Simpson.
Yeah.
But he had three kids, a detached house, a wife that stayed at home, he had a car, and he had a job, and he wasn't particularly productive. Yeah. And that was considered normal. They weren't holding him out to be some sort of high flyer or particularly lucky. It was just like, this is normal. This is life in America.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be able to do that now.
Yeah.
Marge would have to be working and they'd have a child.
Yeah.
Right. And probably compromising on other things. And they would then be in a much smaller house, maybe a flat. Because you can't buy it. You can't buy it without having two parents working. Because the amount you need to borrow is so much.
Not only that, you're probably renting it.
You're probably renting it. Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
And then you don't have the security. And if whether you rent it or you buy it, you're then paying money for in exchange for something you don't own. Right. So let's say they bought the house. A lot of the money they pay back is to pay interest on the money they borrowed that did not exist before they asked to borrow it. The bank created a loan out of thin air, allowed them to buy the house, then charges them interest on the money they created out of thin air. And then Homer and Marge work there, spend 30, 40 years paying back the cost of buying something that is an unproductive asset, which means they can't save. They're still doing the same job, but they can't save. They can't invest in themselves. They can't invest in their children. They can't invest in a business. They can't productively use their savings to further drive productivity in the economy and further drive quality of life improvements for everybody. Yeah. And so it undermines everything. It turns people into serfs, effectively. You are working to live in a house and have food on the table. But you have to compromise as well because they can't afford three kids anymore. They can afford one.
Yeah.
Because Marge would have to take time off work to have the child. Didn't want to spend time with the children. If you wanted to put the child in childcare because you had to work to pay for the mortgage, that would be equally expensive. So you just have fewer children. And this is the economic challenge that people are having. It's like how just having a normal life now is impossible. We have fewer children as a result.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, you see that propagated in so many different ways, right? Because like not being able, like you can, if you can't feel like you can live, just like you are put on this earth, doesn't matter your background, doesn't matter your like economic background, your cultural background, it doesn't matter. If you don't feel like you can live, you're not going to be happy. And if you're not going to be happy, you're going to see all these metrics that are going to show downward trajectories, right? You're going to see more anxiety and depression. You're going to see more obesity. We're going to see more disillusionment. We're going to see more political violence. We're going to see more violence. We're going to see more isolation and people feeling like they can't get ahead in life. You're going to feel like newer generations can't feel like they can get ahead of the older generations, right? You have all these downstream effects of people just feeling unhappy. And that's one of the like underlying factors. And in our society, not being able to live is one of the best ways for people to feel unhappy, right? Yeah. It's just, you just feel like you can't live.
You feel trapped.
Yeah.
You feel trapped. You can't have the lives of your parents. You can't do the things that matter to you as a human being.
Right.
Which is raising a family, yeah, investing in the future, having a long-term outlook.
Yeah.
You can't have a long-term outlook because you don't even know if you're renting, whether you're even going to be able to afford the same place in a year's time. It's like, how can you plan? How can you put down roots? And if you're thinking about, if you're experiencing contraction in your living experience, and you see your ability to buy assets in the future to be able to allow you to put down roots and foundations to have a family, if you think that's never going to happen,
you just
change. You stop sacrificing. You stop saving because what's the point? What's the point? If I put money in the bank, it melts. I'm never going to be able to save enough to buy the house, without taking out monstrous debt, being shackled to that forever. And my wife will have to as well. And we'll never be able to have kids anyway. So what's the point? I'm gonna go on holiday. I'm gonna enjoy myself. Like, so your investment in the future, your investment in society,
that's so profound.
Starts to crumble. And this is why we see a lack of interest in the younger generations in, you know, having a family, sacrificing for the long term, much more short term. Is why we have fewer children. It's why, you know, the demographics are rolling over in all the Western economies. It's because we just print money. We print money and it destroys everything.
Yeah. It's so crazy, right? So like the reason why we're here is because we print money. Before the podcast, I feel like most of the audience would hear that statement and be like, Joe and Farzad are crazy. They are crazy people saying the craziest thing I've ever heard. And now 50 minutes in or whatever, it's 50 minutes in, it's like, I think you've laid out a very logical path as to why having things like fiat money and being able to just have that red button and just printing money, the downstream effects of that are so prevalent and so like, it's just tentacles that go all over the place, you know, that create this underlying almost rot in society that accelerates the wrong incentives and it accelerates the wrong outcomes. And it doesn't allow humanity, it doesn't incentivize humanity to be human. It incentivizes humanity to be more productive than they should be in the things that they shouldn't even be productive in. They should, like, it doesn't allow people to like go to the right place. We don't have the right signals in place. You know, it's pretty crazy. It really is crazy once you think about it.
I agree with all of that apart from one thing, Farzad.
Okay.
We are less productive.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Because you know, we may be forced to work more, but we're not productive.
Yeah.
Right. Because everything's 100%. Distorted. All the price signals are distorted.
Yeah. You're right.
And, you know, the consequences of this chain of thinking and the cause and effect, you know, all these rots in society, but those rots present themselves to the population, which then give the government reason to interfere further in society.
Yeah.
To try and fix these issues.
Yeah.
But they do that by spending more. So how do they spend more? They print more money. They issue more debt. And so by doing that, you further distort the price signals and you just drive the same thing again.
Yeah, it's a flywheel. Right?
And it means that the government is not accountable and is never, ever going to be accountable. And we'll just print money forever. But what happens is it's not just businesses. It's not just individuals that get pulled closer to the government. It is businesses become almost indistinguishable from the government. You get parasitic industries that just grow up helping the government deal with some of the problems they've created. And the government becomes sort of codependent on them, like the pharmaceutical industry, Wall Street.
Yeah.
You know, you have, and the government becomes protective over these industries.
Yeah.
Over and above the population rather than the other way around.
Yeah.
Because
that's so true.
To approach it another way would be to lose control. And so you have to maintain the outward view of control and being able to solve these problems by pulling those industries closer and closer and closer and beginning to clamp down on critical thinking, misinformation, disinformation in the population, because you can't have people questioning the narrative or the logic, or, you know, what's that big red button in the corner over there, guys?
Yeah.
You can't have that.
Yeah.
But when you can print money whenever you want, it means you can finance any wars you want.
Right.
And so, you know, what happens? You start wars everywhere.
Yeah.
Because it's a great way. I'm very careful what I say.
I mean, we have a military industrial complex for a reason.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that.
It's a great business. You know? It's a great business.
It is a great business.
You can print money indefinitely.
Yeah. And that's not a secret. It's not a secret. Yeah.
No, but what you could do with all of these things is spend the money and then go to the population and say, we've got a bill that needs to be paid.
Right, of course.
And then your taxes go up, there's a clampdown on freedoms, etc. And any shortfall will just issue more debt and print more money to cover it anyway. And the natural consequence of all of these things is the money goes down in purchasing power forever. Because the governments can never go bust. If you print your own currency, you can never go bust. You would never choose to go bust. You would just print more money.
And the game is like in the game of the world powers who all have access to this button. The game is I'm going to press this button less than you are, and I'm going to hope that you will press it more than I will. And then I'm going to create incentives or actually execute on actions that's going to cause you to press your button more so that I don't have to press it as much. But it's inevitable where I have to press it. And so that's the game, right? I feel like that's the game that we're playing globally, is like who can press the button less. But it all leads to the same place eventually.
Yeah. And we see this in the purchasing power. So all the currencies float against one another, and the dollar can become stronger or weaker over time. But I mean, in 50 years, the dollar just becomes ever stronger gradually because you've got the dollar's baked at the center of the financial system and everyone else saves in the dollar typically, which means there's more demand for dollars over time and a lot of borrowing is in dollars. There's lots of reasons why the dollar tends to be stronger, which is it's just totally demolished your industrial sector because, you know, it's much easier to import than export, et cetera, et cetera. Yep. So, you know, there's prices you pay for that. But the US is in a very privileged position in the financial system. However, you've sort of shot yourself in the foot because the US for 50 years has encouraged everyone else to save in dollars and to hold treasuries and treasury bills. And then when someone does something you don't like, you invalidate them. And so, you know, when Russia and Ukraine kicked off, Russians became very clear that the things they owned in dollars, they didn't really own. And when that happens, everyone else starts questioning, well, hang on, what about the dollar instruments I own? Do I really own them?
They could just turn it off.
Well, I own them as long as I'm not doing something that America doesn't want me to do. Yeah. And so, you know, there's a dynamic there as well. But ultimately, all fiat currencies are going in the same direction, and that is to zero. The dollar is going to zero purchasing power. The euro is going to zero purchasing power. The pound is going to zero purchasing power. It's everybody at home already knows this. Like you'd think that would be a controversial statement. But you know, like if I gave you money now and I said, put it in the bank for 10 years, put it in the bank for 100 years, it would buy nothing.
That's why people used to put their money under their mattress, right? That's like a whole saying here. It's like, hey, put your money under the mattress. That was like 100, you know, how many generations ago or whatever. And now people are like, oh, yeah, no, don't do that. It's going to be worthless. You got to buy something. You got to buy stock. You got to buy a house. You got to do this. You got to do that. Like, and that's crazy, right? It's like the work you put in goes away. The value you brought to the civilization just disappears. It's gone. Like a fart. It's gone.
I mean, unlike a fart, it's
hopefully
it's being stolen. I'm not sure that anyone would want to steal that. It's not That's just fair. Disappearing. It's not disappearing.
Yeah, it's being taken from you
miraculously. It's being stolen.
Yeah,
it's being stolen from you, and that should make people angry. But everyone already knows. They know deep down whether they've really thought about it and articulated it or not. But they know because they see it all the time. They know they can't save. And why can't they save? It's because the money's broken. So imagine a world where the money wasn't broken. Imagine you could go and do a day's work. And tomorrow and next year and in 10 years' time, it retains the work that you put into it to allow you to redeploy that in exchange for something you wanted at that point in time. Think about how that would change your decision-making. You could have confidence in the future. You could plan for the future. What would that mean about your spending? You would be apply much greater level of critical thinking around your spending decisions. Would you make better or worse decisions? You'd make much better decisions because you wouldn't have the time pressure. You'd be thinking about the opportunity cost if I don't spend this today, I'm not foregoing anything. Yeah. Or prices are going down. It will buy more in a year's time than it does today because the productivity of society is accruing to the money. So it benefits us all. Yeah. So I'll now spend on the things that I actually do need to spend on. And I'll invest in the things that I think are going to drive a real productive value. Return over yeah. and above the return I'll get when the money just becomes more valuable through productivity gains. That is the stable foundation for a society to prosper long term.
Yeah.
And you just think about the compounding effect of that. It's astronomical, absolutely astronomical. And what that does then, if you have a money that's not melting, you don't buy houses. You don't speculate on the stock market. Because if the money is going up in value, you don't need to. The reason that people are buying these second homes is to get on the right side of the money printer or to lose less because of the money printer. But if the money becomes more valuable, you don't have to risk it to keep it. Right. You just keep it. So house prices start to come down to normal levels again, like they were 50, 60 years ago. And so now the families don't have to leverage themselves to the eyeballs to buy a house. And you can buy a house on one salary again, and you can have three kids, and the wife can stay at home and raise the family if you choose to do so.
Right.
This is how we restore America. This is how we restore the West, is by separating money and state. Nobody should have access to a big red button. Nobody should be able to print for free what you have to exchange your life for. Right.
Yeah.
And that is should not be a controversial statement.
I agree.
But if you fix these things, it fixes everything. So, you know, Bitcoin, and obviously we're talking about Bitcoin here. Bitcoin is saying, like, if you fix the money, you fix the world. Right. And we've just talked about why the world is the way it is. It's because the money's broken. So if you fix the money, you fix the world. Right. You defund the military industrial complex. Think about all the positive aspects that come from this. The greater level of individual rights, the greater level of alignment that every individual will feel with society on the long term because of this. It just fixes everything.
Yeah.
It fixes everything. And there has never been a point in history where we have had the opportunity to actually separate money and state because the technology has never existed. You know, we've had periods in the past where we've been on a gold standard. I mean, very unlikely many of your listeners, and certainly neither you or I, remember that time. Right. But that ended in 1971. But before 1971, if you were a foreign central bank, it didn't apply to the individuals. That was repealed earlier on. But you could exchange your dollars for gold.
Right.
So after the Second World War, the US became the center of the financial system and said, we're gonna peg dollars to gold and everyone else can peg to the dollar. So you can hold treasuries, we'll hold the gold. But whenever you want to get the gold back, just give us the dollars, we'll give you the gold. That's fine as long as you keep your promise.
Right.
But eventually the US just succumbed to the ability to print more money and prints more money. And then the French say, hang on, where are you getting all this money for the wars from? We don't trust you. You haven't printed a load of extra dollars. Can we have our gold back? Here are your dollars. And then Nixon goes,
you gotta run.
No, sorry. Sorry. So now we live in a fiat world. But before that, it was constrained. It was constrained in some way. And it was constrained to the physical world. Through gold, right. And gold was energy money, right? And so, you know, I think people may struggle when we talk about the way the world is the way it is because of fiat money to then make the leap to Bitcoin as being the solution because it seems so inaccessible and so ephemeral, and
It's a number on a spreadsheet, right, to a lot of people, and it's conceptually, which is hilariously, it's no different than fiat, but anyway, so, yeah. but it's like this techie thing that is, it has a lot of, you know, you have Bitcoin Core, and then you have all these forks, and then you got, you know, Bitcoin Cash, I think it's called, and then you have all these layers on top of Bitcoin, and then, you know, 99% of Bitcoin resources are, they're brilliant people, but forget bringing it down to a level where the common person can understand it, partly because the education around around money, the economy, finance, et cetera, is just so poor, especially in the United States. From my experience, very few people actually understand what money is. Like, what is money? You know, and it's I think there's so many factors that make Bitcoin difficult to sort of wrap your head around. But I think the okay, so you said gold is energy. Is it energy money? Yeah. And so we know Bitcoin. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, so maybe to address that specific point, Faz, I think a lot of people just have not really thought about what's money.
Yeah.
What's money? What we have is monopoly money. You can print it for free.
Yeah.
Like the government, if you have a license, you can print it for free. It's not bounded by any real world energy anymore. When it was convertible into gold, and everyone listening here, I'd be amazed if you had anyone listening who thought gold wasn't valuable, right? Because we all just intuitively know that gold has value.
Right.
But most people haven't really perhaps ever thought about why gold has value.
Yeah.
But gold has value because it has most of the qualities of money to a good enough degree that it became the gorilla in the room, or the way people stored their wealth. You know, some people will have used silver, some people use copper, beads, whatever. Eventually it gets outcompeted by gold because gold is good enough money on most characteristics.
Yeah.
But what does that really mean? Well, it's good enough money because it's limited in supply to a degree. Right? You can't just print gold. You have to do work to bring gold into circulation. Like there's plenty of gold beneath our feet, an infinite amount in the universe, but in circulation, it's limited by nature.
And so we'll walk through that, right? So it's you have to prospect it, you have to harvest it, you have to process it, you have to store it, right? So that's the work that goes into, you know, getting gold out of the earth and putting it in a place. And, you know, getting it to the place and storing the place and making sure that it's safe, et cetera, et cetera. That's all energy and work that has to be put in to ensure that money can be used.
Exactly.
Fair?
Exactly. Yeah. And everyone intuitively knows that. It's like you can't create it for free. Exactly. And because it's limited in supply. It's hard money with soft edges. You know, the price of gold goes up. They dig more out of the ground. They raise more equity. Yep. You know, and so the supply goes up as the price goes up and it comes back down. But it's the hardest money we had. It's hard money with soft edges. And was used as a medium of exchange. Like you make it into coins, you can exchange it. It's hard to verify. Like you can't be sure if someone gives you a bar of gold whether it's actually gold. You can't send it on the internet. You can't buy a can of Coke in the shop with gold, and you can't get change in gold. You can't really secure it. It's you can take a bag of gold around with you, but you wouldn't really want to, right? So it has good enough characteristics, but it fails as a currency, really. And that's why we have the paper. We have the paper layer because people had the gold. They put the gold in the gold vaults. And the gold vaults issued them paper in return, and they had receipts that said, I own a bit of gold, and they gave that as payment.
Right. And the paper was divisible in a way that's much easier to divide into very small units where you can actually transact with other humans. So if you want to buy a pen, it makes it easy to buy a pen because, you know, a coin of gold is probably going to buy you 1,000 pens or 10,000 pens. But if you just wanted to buy one pen, having that paper money that's divisible into equal parts makes it a lot easier to buy that one pen. And that's why we have the money we had, or had, roughly.
Exactly. But that was just a promise to the gold underneath, and you could always get the paper, right. Go to the vault and say, give me the gold. And
get the gold.
But no one did, because the gold, you don't want to have to secure it. As soon as you have a certain amount, you're worried about someone breaking in, so you go and put it back in the gold vault.
So it was a pain in the ass, and the risk to carry the paper and the promise was worth the pain in the ass of lugging all that shit around. Yeah.
Yeah, and it just makes commerce easier. Because then you just go to ledgers, like quite often in the phone and the telegraph get invented, and you can send money across the world. It's not money, you're just one ledger. Someone writes, I've sent you $1,000, and over there goes, you sent me $1,000. Yeah. Like nothing actually changes, right? But that's how money started moving around. And this is where the dollar came from, where fiat, where the paper layer came from. Its currency is separated from money in the existing system. And then in 71, Nixon cut the link completely. So now we just have currency, not backed by anything. And as you say, all the governments, central banks, they print money and they steal the purchasing power of everybody because we're using monopoly money.
Well, the government would say that it's backed by the trust, the full trust and the military prowess of the United States government. That's what they would say.
It's enforced by the military prowess, not backed by.
Fair. You got it. Yeah.
Use our currency or else you get invaded. Pretty much. Sadly. Like the US is the center of the financial system. And if you try to diverge from that or threaten that,
you're gonna
something
get a
bad happens.
Yeah.
So it's enforced. It's not backed. And certainly not as far as the population and protecting the population's value of the currency in any way. And so if you recognize for a moment that money is those characteristics of money that made gold valuable as the money, and that gold had a shortfall on that set of characteristics, then when something comes along that on those same set of characteristics not only surpasses gold, but completes them, reaches a point where you could not possibly have anything better in those characteristics. And then that is all in the same thing. That thing is perfect money. It is, and it's Bitcoin. Bitcoin is the perfection of money. It is, you know, gold was inefficient energy money. Bitcoin is perfect energy money. It's the apex evolution of money. It's the money and the currency in the same thing. Like if Bitcoin had been around at the same time as gold before we put the paper layer on, we'd have used Bitcoin already. It's the fact that gold fell short on those characteristics that we put the paper layer in place. Because you don't need the paper layer with Bitcoin because it's peer-to-peer electronic cash, rules without rulers, independent of everybody, controlled by no one, a fixed supply forever, with the remainder coming into existence via a free market process, rooted in electrical energy where everybody competes globally to bring the remaining Bitcoin into existence, which secures the network to ensure it's untamperable forever. And it goes on the internet. You can send it at the speed of light anywhere in the world to anybody, receive it from anybody. Nobody can stop you. Nobody can take it off you. No one can even prove you have it or don't have it. It's perfect money. It's perfect money. And you can do it at almost zero cost.
Yeah.
This is technology. This is maths. This is encryption. This is human ingenuity perfecting money.
Yeah.
And if you think about the civilizational uplift we are going to have as the world realizes what Bitcoin is, there's the human renaissance coming across the world. But just so few people understand. And you're never going to recognize a solution unless you understand the problem. And so, you know, if you watch what's the problem, you'll understand what the problem is. And then you'll actually recognize the solution. Bitcoin is the way we separate money and state. It's the way we reinstate human rights for everyone around the world. You know, It's about the individual. It's the individual working in their own self-interest, the benefit of everybody else. The productivity of the world accrues to humanity again and drives a quality of living increase for everybody across the world. It unlocks the global free market. It's money without borders. It's money for your enemies.
Yeah.
It's there are very few times in civilization where something comes along that just changes everything.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, I think it's helpful for people to sort of try and attach something new to a mental model they're comfortable with. So, you know, we've talked about Bitcoin being the perfection of gold and energy money. So if you accept that gold is valuable and the reasons for it, you're going to love Bitcoin, right? It's complex, but you're going to love Bitcoin. If you recognize the impact gunpowder had on the world, you realize that there was no neutral strategy for engaging with gunpowder. The first person who invents gunpowder invades you.
Wins.
Yeah. You either adopt gunpowder as well, or you lose.
Right? Yeah.
And then the internet comes along, and you either engage with the internet, or you lose. It's a massive asymmetrical advantage that ultimately everybody adopts, and you never go back. There's never going to be
fire,
a world
the
without...
wheel, right? Yeah,
exactly.
Fire. It's you got all these things.
Yeah. It's a civilizational change technology.
Yeah.
That is undergoing an adoption curve, and that adoption curve is just think about it like the internet. This is 1995 in the internet. And 30 years later, the internet is largely unchanged, but it's just ubiquitous.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't have thought in 1995 that in 30 years' time, everyone will be on the internet.
Like, what's even crazier,
Joe? It was almost impossible to get on the internet. It took forever.
You know, what's even crazier is that if you really think about the internet example, because I think that internet example is such a good, it's a good mental model for me to understand Bitcoin's long-term potential. But as I've had more conversations, it's much more closer to like fire or the wheel or gunpowder. Like it's really foundational to civilization. It's so foundational. The internet is as well. But it's like, I think using like a even older example to paint it. Anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that I forgot. Fuck, it just left my brain. Holy shit. Okay.
It's a civilizational change. And so
yeah.
But like any other technology, it comes in gradually. It's not like a lockstep. It's not a lockstep change, especially because it's not mandated. It's not mandated by some authority, some government. Like the US government could come in and say we're changing the currency tomorrow. And suddenly, you know, we're all using the euro, right? They could do that tomorrow.
No, thanks.
unlikely. But they could do that because it's mandated. But for a core technology, which is adopted from a ground up movement, it happens very, very gradually over time because it's inaccessible. Initially, it's only accessible to the 100 or 200 cryptographers that receive the email. And then some time goes by, they explain it to some other people in an acceptable way or accessible way. And so over time, you just make it, you make the surface area of adoption bigger and bigger and bigger. But that's just from an education perspective.
Right.
Forget that it's not very consumer friendly. You know, it's like the internet in the 90s. It was really hard to get online. You didn't have the iPhone, the iPad. You didn't have Wi-Fi. You didn't have all of these things that make getting on the internet super easy and remove all the barriers for everyone. Whereas now it's just so obvious that everyone's connected and almost everything is connected to the internet. The internet itself hasn't really changed.
I remember the point I was going to make.
Yeah.
The internet piece, right? In even then, even 30 years after the invention of the internet, there's still 3 billion people on the planet that don't have it. Even then.
There you go. And so it's not even at full adoption now, but that took 30 years to get there. Yeah. And the internet was invented in what, 60s? And so... Yeah. So to think about Bitcoin now after 16 years, it was just so incredibly early. It's at, you know, 1-2% of global adoption, and it's probably less than that is the incidence at which people would say, would answer correctly, why do we need Bitcoin? The answer to why we need Bitcoin is we separate money and state.
But yeah.
Much less than 1% of people in the world would give you that answer when asked that question because they don't understand. They don't understand the problem, and therefore they don't understand the solution. And the accessibility for both is low. But over time, we improve all of these things. We make it more accessible. We make it more UX friendly. We improve the UX around these things. And eventually it gets to 70% of the world's population in 30 or 40 years' time. But that is the secular trend that we are just embarking upon. So when people look at Bitcoin, they think, oh, I've missed it. I've missed it. You haven't missed it. You haven't missed it. It's like saying I missed the internet in 1995.
Yeah.
And so, you know, encourage people to zoom out. And, it, you know, if like I do, I see a future where Bitcoin is the money of the world. And I think ultimately the path there is there'll be a point in the future where there's really only two currencies, an East currency and money interchangeably. One is Bitcoin and one is the dollar.
Yeah.
And then eventually it'll just be Bitcoin because the dollar will be backed by Bitcoin because it's the only way. Bitcoin is the only way governments get out of the insolvency that they're in. And then we're all on Bitcoin. And for me, that is, I'm clear in that view. It's just going to take decades to play out. But when you have conviction rooted in logic and critical thinking, it's very, very empowering. And so you know, you talked earlier about you've got friends who are in Bitcoin. I bet they're super motivated people and very individually empowered people because they feel like they have control of their life.
Yes.
I'm no longer subject to the money printer.
Right.
I recognize it for what it is. And because of that, I can make decisions differently for myself and for my family. And I can take steps to protect my family from the theft that is occurring.
Yeah.
I can own something that no one can take off me ever without my permission. And they can't print it. And ultimately, in my view, everyone in the world is going to own it. Every individual, business, country, not just going to accept Bitcoin, they're going to prefer Bitcoin and then ultimately only accept Bitcoin. And, you know, I must say, none of this is financial advice. Obviously, this is my view, et cetera. But I would encourage people to look again at Bitcoin, because the information you are given in the media from the government or from other people who speak with confidence but haven't done the work themselves is probably to take you in the wrong direction and put you in a mental place where you've already written it off.
Yeah.
And there are fewer higher return on investment things you can do in your life right now than start again with Bitcoin. Your future self is going to thank you. And you will never see the world in the same way again. And it will be incredibly empowering, motivating, energizing, and give you a very long-term outlook for the future.
Yeah.
And I would say I have never been as positive about the future as I am right now, despite what is happening in the world.
Yeah.
And that's because of Bitcoin.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Make sure you go check out What's the Problem by Joe Brian on the internet. We've also done a series of Bitcoin videos on this channel as well with Cern Basher, and we did one with Constantine and Topher. Obviously, if you made it to the end of this video, which I have a feeling a lot of people will, Joe, make sure you go check out at Satmo Joe on X. Is that your handle there? S-A-T-M-O Joe?
It is, yeah.
Perfect.
S-A-T-M-O-J-O-E.
Perfect. And I mean, I'll, before we wrap this up, I mean, I'll speak personally about my sort of Bitcoin journey. Is like, you know, from my perspective, some people, you know, I have friends that will say, you know, Bitcoin doesn't have any value. It's just a number. It's just whatever. But then I have so many stories from people that live in countries where their governments are 100 times more dysfunctional than in the United States. And many of them are using Bitcoin to protect themselves against that very dysfunctional government, because that government obviously has their currency, and oftentimes they mismanage the currency so poorly that they lose their ability to live extremely quickly, and they use Bitcoin as a way to protect themselves because they can have access to Bitcoin just by having the internet and a computer or a phone. So it makes it very easy for them to protect themselves against theft, right? At the most fundamental level. And so that was a very eye-opening thing for me to learn. And then the more I've dug into it, the more I'm like, you know, and your process of explaining this, which I think is the most sort of like root cause, first principles way of thinking about it from a societal perspective and like a human condition perspective and a sort of incentives and how governments like to function perspective, like a true societal civilizational perspective. I think your video does the best sort of service to communicate that. And then as people go through that journey, I encourage them to sort of dig into the technical aspects of it. And because there's so much literature out there that will, I think, help people understand a lot of their concerns. But at the same time, I encourage everybody to never stop doing that research and never stop challenging the thesis of Bitcoin. Because I think what it's done for me, it's one of those very rare place things that I've studied that it's like, man, it's really hard to find a thing that goes against it. It's just it has an answer for basically everything. Even in the sort of the quantum computing sort of question that gets raised from a technical perspective, it's like, well, you know, when we have a computer that can solve for the cryptography, right, then everyone's wallets are gone. And so it's like, okay, if that world exists where anybody can steal anything, Bitcoin is going to be the least of your worries. You're going to have Wells Fargo is going to have to worry way before Bitcoin. You know, all these giant corporations and banks and firms, all those guys are way, way screwed before Bitcoin gets impacted. So even in that world. And then of course the opposing answer to that is like, well, you can use that same exact layer to protect yourself against that thing. So you can build that into Bitcoin. Bitcoin can absorb that as well. So the technical aspect of it is also, there's a solution for that. Anyway, this is all to say, thank you very much for coming on, Joe. This was a very enlightening conversation for me. This Bitcoin thing is just always, all these light bulbs go off. And any last words for the audience?
Well, I would say thank you for having me on. I'd also say, don't trust me at all. You know, don't trust anyone.
Yeah.
Don't trust anyone. Do your own research, do your own learning. Encourage everybody to watch What's the Problem. And then when you've watched What's the Problem, you can just go to whattheproblem.org. And there's some additional videos there which explain some of these other things. Easy first step videos on the technology or on the societal impacts or on the human rights support that it provides people around the world and commerce and all of these things. Bitcoin is a multi-headed hydra. You won't be interested in every aspect, but there's bound to be one that you are to get started. And I would just encourage everybody to start afresh.
Thank you, Joe.
All right. Thank you.